rates were relatively modest. The original federal income tax rates in 1913 were, in inflation-adjusted brackets, as follows. 1% for incomes up to $463,826, 2% for incomes between $463,826 to $1,159,566, 3% for incomes between $1,159,566 to $1,739,348, 4% for incomes between $1,739,348 to $2,319,131, 5% for incomes between $2,319,131 to $5,797,828, 6% for incomes between $5,797,828 to $11,595,657, and 7% for incomes over $11,595,657. Whereas the top rate in 1913 was 7%, which applied to very few individuals, federal income tax rates today are far more onerous. In the first place, in 2009, for which the latest numbers are available, the CBO reports that the bottom 20% of income earners' average rate for the individual income tax was negative 9.3%. For those in the 20 to 40% range of income earners, the average income tax was a little over negative 2%. Refundable tax credits exceeded the income tax owed by these individuals. Thus, the income tax system today not only is intended to tax higher earners at higher rates, but directly subsidizes a substantial portion of the population with cash payments. In 2009, for individuals in the 40 to 60% range, the average income tax was 1.3%, while those in the 60 to 80% range had an average income tax rate of 4.6%. The top 20% of earners paid, on average, a 13.4% income tax rate, while the top 1% paid, on average, 21%. The Tax Foundation reports that the federal deficit each year has grown so large that even if the government took all of the income earned by those who have an after-tax income of $1 million or more, the amount of revenue generated would fall far short of eliminating the over $1 trillion deficit each year. In 2010, for example, the after-tax income of all millionaires was about $709 billion. The 2012 fiscal operating deficit was $1.32 trillion. It follows that higher income earners account for most of the individual income tax revenue the federal government receives. The top 1%, adjusted gross income, AGI, of $343,927 and above, paid 36.73% of federal income taxes. The top 5%, AGI of $154,642 and above, paid 58.66%. The top 10%, AGI of $112,124 and above, paid 70.47%. The top 25%, AGI of $66,193 and above, paid 87.3%. The top 50%, AGI of $32,396 and above, paid 97.75%. Put another way, the Tax Foundation explains that the share of taxes paid by the richest 10% of households, the share of all market income earned by that group, and the ratio of what that 10% of households pays in taxes versus what they can earn as a share of the nation's income is the highest or most progressive in the industrialized world. In 2013, the effective tax rate for the wealthiest households will increase further as itemized deductions have been eliminated or phased out. Hence, class warfare, or soaking the so-called rich, may make for good populist demagoguery and serve the political ends of the governing masterminds, but it does nothing to solve the grave realities of the federal government's insatiable appetite for spending and its inability to reform itself. The current spending trend makes certain an immense tax increase on the vast majority of income-earning Americans, despite the overall inconsequence of taxation on bringing down the overall debt. There is already talk of a VAT, which is an enormous hidden sales tax levied at every level of production and service and drives up prices to the consumer, overhauling the over $3 trillion 401k retirement system, including the elimination of nearly $80 billion in deferred taxation, reducing or eliminating the home mortgage interest deduction, and reducing or eliminating charitable deductions. While terribly destructive of individual and private sector wealth, these taxes and others will be meaningless and increasingly desperate gestures. New York Times columnist and leftist economist Paul Krugman, in a moment of candor, stated, "Eventually we do have a problem. That the population is getting older, healthcare costs are rising, there is this question of how we're going to pay for the programs. The year 2025, the year 2030, something is going to have to give. We're going to need more revenue. Surely it will require some sort of middle-class taxes as well. We won't be able to pay for the kind of government the society will want without some increase in taxes. On the middle class, maybe a value-added tax. We're also going to have to make decisions about health care, not pay for health care that has no demonstrated medical benefits." So the snarky version, which I shouldn't even say because it will get me in trouble, is death panels and sales taxes is how we do this. In addition to the financial burden and economic dislocation, the tax system and Internal Revenue Code have become so complex and oppressive that the federal government's National Taxpayer Advocate reported in 2012, U.S. taxpayers, both individuals and businesses, spend more than 6.1 billion hours to complete filings required by a tax code that contains almost 4 million words and that on average has more than one new provision added to it daily. Indeed, few taxpayers complete their returns without assistance. Nearly 60% of taxpayers hire paid preparers, and another 30% rely on commercial software to prepare their returns. Therefore, not only is the individual's wealth diminished by confiscatory taxation applied to unconstitutional purposes, but he is tormented by the manner in which he calculates and confers his wealth to the federal government, for which fines and penalties are imposed for miscalculations. Moreover, the recent scandal involving the widespread targeting of Tea Party, conservative, and religious groups for abusive, if not unlawful, scrutiny, the purpose of which was to deter them from pursuing tax-exempt designations and fully participating in public advocacy, is the latest in a long history of egregious manipulation and politicization of the Internal Revenue Service by, among others, presidents, members of Congress, and partisan bureaucrats. Over time, the limitations on the taxing power contemplated by the framers and enshrined in the Constitution have been steadily eroded. Most recently and grievously, in the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision on June 28, 2012, in National Federation of Independent Business et al. Versus Sebelius, Secretary of Health and Human Services et al., aka the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare case, the court issued the most unscrupulous of modern judicial rulings, in which it not only distorted the federal government's taxing power beyond all recognition, but also used that power to alter fundamentally the relationship between the individual and the federal government. The majority, led by Chief Justice John Roberts, was determined to uphold Obamacare despite the law's unconstitutional mandate, which compelled individuals to engage in commerce, that is, the purchase of a government-designed private health care policy. It seized on the Constitution's original and limited tax provision to rewrite the law. The majority ignored the legislative history, the actual text of the statute, the court's precedent, and the Constitution's text to redefine Obamacare's penalty provision as a tax. As the dissent wrote, in part, "Judicial tax writing is particularly troubling. Taxes have never been popular, see, e.g., Stamp Act of 1765, and in part for that reason, the Constitution requires tax increases to originate in the House of Representatives. That is to say, they must originate in the legislative body most accountable to the people, where legislators must weigh the need for the tax against the terrible price they might pay at their next election, which is never more than 2 years off." The Federalist No. 58 defended the decision to give the origination power to the House on the ground that the chamber that is more accountable to the people should have the primary role in raising revenue. We have no doubt that Congress knew precisely what it was doing when it rejected an earlier version of this legislation that imposed a tax instead of a requirement with penalty. Imposing a tax through judicial legislation inverts the constitutional scheme and places the power to tax in the branch of government least accountable to the citizenry. And, on top of it all, Obamacare relies heavily on the IRS to enforce key provisions of the law. In addition to hiring thousands of new staffers, including auditors, a recent Treasury Department Inspector General report discloses that the IRS has created several committees, offices, and teams to implement and oversee Obamacare. The Affordable Care Act, ACA, Executive Steering Committee, ESC, is responsible for overall program coordination and implementation of the ACA across the IRS. This committee is co-chaired by the Deputy Commissioner for Services and Enforcement and the Deputy Commissioner for Operations Support. It also includes the IRS Chief of Staff and other IRS executives, including the Business Operating Division Commissioners et al. 3 Program Management Offices, PMO. 1. Services and Enforcement. 2. Modernization and Information Technology Services, MITS. And 3. Healthcare Council. These PMOs are accountable to the ESC for ACA implementation and work with the IRS business operating divisions to ensure efforts are successfully coordinated. 4 functional ESCs, each led by an executive chair, have responsibility for specific provisions in the ACA that directly affect the 4 business operating divisions, wage and investment, small business / self-employed, large business and international, and tax-exempt / government entities. The Services and Enforcement Exchange Working Teams are responsible for planning the implementation of the exchange provisions scheduled for 2014. Amos Singletary's fears, among those of others, are now fully realized. The proposed tax amendment would set a ceiling for income earners at 15%. It provides a degree of flexibility by allowing Congress to institute a flat tax lower than 15% or additional income-based tax rates below the 15% cap. Thus, individuals at lower income levels, such as those who work part-time, students with summer jobs, adults in low-skilled jobs, retired senior citizens, etc., would pay less in taxes in absolute dollars and or be subject to lower tax rates. The proposed tax amendment eliminates all forms of double taxation, including the so-called inheritance or death tax, A tax on estates, often passed from parents and grandparents to the offspring. Taxes on investment income, which promotes wealth creation and economic growth, and taxes on corporations, which reduces research, capital expansion, and job creation. In most cases, these taxes have been layered upon income taxes already paid by individuals. Moreover, the proposed tax and spending amendments together will force Congress to address the growing catastrophe of unfunded obligations, including reforming the Medicare and Social Security programs to meet inescapable actuarial and economic realities. Finally, the current Rube Goldberg-like tax code will be dispatched, along with much of the IRS bureaucracy, and replaced with a relatively simple and straightforward tax collection system. The cap on taxes will also eliminate the confiscatory and complex nature of federal taxation that exists today. The framers' expectation that federal spending and taxes would be limited to support only explicitly constitutional functions, to pay debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare, has been distorted deliberately as part of the statists' design. It is folly to believe that Congress and the President on their own will make the necessary and difficult decisions to address the impending financial debacle. After all, they and their predecessors engineered the approaching tsunami. As the situation becomes direr, the federal government's actions will grow more oppressive. The proposed spending and tax amendments work in conjunction and seek to avert a societal implosion. Chapter 6. An Amendment to Limit the Federal Bureaucracy. Section 1. All federal departments and agencies shall expire if said departments and agencies are not individually reauthorized in standalone reauthorization bills every 3 years by a majority vote of the House of Representatives and the Senate. Section 2. All executive branch regulations exceeding an economic burden of $100 million, as determined jointly by the Government Accountability Office and the Congressional Budget Office, shall be submitted to a permanent joint committee of Congress, hereafter the Congressional Delegation Oversight Committee, for review and approval prior to their implementation. Section 3. The committee shall consist of 7 members of the House of Representatives, 4 chosen by the Speaker and 3 chosen by the Minority Leader, and 7 members of the Senate, 4 chosen by the Majority Leader and 3 chosen by the Minority Leader. No member shall serve on the committee beyond a single 3-year term. Section 4. The committee shall vote no later than 6 months from the date of the submission of the regulation to the committee. The committee shall make no change to the regulation, either approving or disapproving the regulation, by majority vote, as submitted. Section 5. If the committee does not act within 6 months from the date of the submission of the regulation to the regulation shall be considered disapproved and must not be implemented by the executive branch. In elementary school, children are taught that the Constitution establishes a federal government composed of 3 branches, the legislative, executive, and judicial. Articles 1, 2, and 3 of the Constitution create and grant limited powers and defined roles to each branch. This concept, known as separation of powers, is designed to ensure that no single body becomes too powerful and thus rules tyrannically over the others, the states and the people. The Constitution, through an arrangement of separate but co-equal branches, checks and balances, enumerated powers, federalism, and a Bill of Rights, diffuses power. This construct was intended to prevent the over-centralization and concentration of power in federal government, and was fundamental to preserving the nature of republican government. Article 1 specifically vests Congress with the legislative power. Congress is most directly accountable to the people, the House, whose members are elected directly, and the Senate, whose members were originally chosen by the states. It stands to reason that the power to establish laws would fall to it. Article 1 provides, in part, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. In Federalist 48, James Madison envisions Congress as potentially the most powerful of the three branches. He explained, "The legislative department derives a superiority in our governments from other circumstances, its constitutional powers being at once more extensive and less susceptible of precise limits. It can, with the greater facility, mask, under complicated and indirect measure, the encroachments which it makes on the coordinate departments." It should be emphasized, however, that Madison did not mean for any branch to act outside its constitutionally prescribed limits. He wrote, "It is agreed on all sides that the powers properly belonging to one of the departments ought not to be directly and completely administered by either of the other departments," and that included Congress. "I do not conceive that power is given to the President and Senate to dismember the empire or to alienate any great essential right. I do not think the whole legislative authority have this power. The exercise of the power must be consistent with the object of the delegation." John Locke, who was the most widely read philosopher during the American Revolutionary period, explained in his extremely influential Second Treatise of Civil Government that a legislative body elected by the people must not delegate the power of lawmaking to any other entity, for that power was delegated to the legislature by the people. Locke wrote, "The legislative cannot transfer the power of making laws to any other hands, for it being but a delegated power from the people, they who have it cannot pass it over to others." He added, "The power of the legislative, being derived from the people by a positive voluntary grant and institutions, can be no other than what that positive grant conveyed, which being only to make laws and not to make legislators, the legislative can have no power to transfer their authority of making laws and place it in other hands." Locke explained that the legislature is not only the supreme power of the Commonwealth, but sacred and unalterable in the hands where the community have one placed it. It is imperative, therefore, that the body chosen by the people and vested with legislative authority enact the laws under which the people live. These are the bounds which the trust that is put in them by the society and the law of God and nature have set to the legislative power of every commonwealth, in all forms of government. Charles de Montesquieu, who was among the most widely read philosophers during the post-revolutionary period, was hugely influential on the framers. He is mentioned several times at the Constitutional Convention, in the Federalist Papers, and during the state ratifying conventions. In his masterpiece, The Spirit of the Laws, Montesquieu first expounded on the concept of three distinct governmental branches, each with separate powers to legislate, execute, and adjudicate. He wrote, "When legislative power is united with executive power in a single person or in a simple body of magistracy, there is no liberty, because one can fear that the same monarch or senate that makes tyrannical laws will execute them tyrannically." The history and philosophy undergirding the separation of powers doctrine and the unique character of the legislative branch and lawmaking is unambiguous. As Madison explained in Federalist 51, "But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. The framers believed that the institutions of government they had created in the Constitution and the specific, limited powers they had granted each of them achieved these ends. In fact, in 1892, the Supreme Court underscored this most basic understanding when it declared in Field v. Clark that the issue of Congress delegating lawmaking authority to the executive branch would raise the constitutional structure the framers had established. The court ruled that Congress cannot delegate legislative power to the president is a principle universally recognized as vital to the integrity and maintenance of the system of government ordained by the Constitution. But, once again, in the late 18th century, as part of the progressive movement's agenda, a concerted campaign was launched to undo the constitutional construct by concentrating and consolidating power in the federal government. As Woodrow Wilson exclaimed in 1908, "The makers of the federal constitution followed the scheme as they found it expounded by Montesquieu, followed it with genuine scientific enthusiasm. The admirable expositions of the Federalist Papers read like thoughtful applications of Montesquieu to the political needs and circumstances of America. They are full of the theory of checks and balances. The president is balanced off against Congress, Congress against the president, and each against the courts. Politics is turned into mechanics under this touch. The trouble with the theory is that government is not a machine, but a living thing. It is modified by its environment, necessitated by its tasks, shaped to its functions by sheer pressure of life. No living thing can have its organs offset against each other as checks and live." In the 1930s and 1940s, President Franklin Roosevelt launched the New Deal, in which Congress passed laws creating federal agencies and delegating power to them to regulate vast segments of the economy and daily life, in many instances bypassing or supplanting state lawmaking authority. Initially, the Supreme Court struck down a number of these programs, ruling that they went far beyond the authority granted the federal government under the Interstate Commerce Clause, including the Railroad Retirement Act's compulsory retirement plans in Railroad Retirement Board versus Alton R. Company, sections of the National Industrial Recovery Act's wage and hour requirements in Schechter Poultry Corporation versus United States, and the Bituminous Coal Conservation Act's establishment of a National Coal Commission and coal districts, as well as the fixing of prices, wages, and hours in Carter versus Carter Coal Company. However, the court would soon reverse course and abandon its own precedent after Roosevelt threatened to change the court's makeup, and over time did in fact replace the sitting justices with men who shared his views. Subsequently, in the 1937 Jones versus Lachlan Steel Corporation case, the court held that intrastate activities that have a close and substantial relation to interstate commerce, that their control is essential or appropriate to protect that commerce from burdens and obstructions, are within Congress's power to regulate. Later, in the 1942 Wickard versus Filburn decision, it went much further, ruling that withholding goods from interstate commerce affects interstate commerce, and therefore such activity is subject to congressional lawmaking power. One of Roosevelt's most prominent advisors, Harvard Law professor James Landis, insisted in 1938 that, in terms of political theory, the administrative process springs from the inadequacy of a simple tripartite form of government to deal with modern problems. These days, Each of the federal branches has seized expanded authority over the states and the individual. In addition to Congress's legislative authority, it is now commonplace for the courts to legislate by judicial review and the executive branch to legislate by regulation and executive order. More to the justification of the proposed amendment, the vastness of the federal bureaucracy, that is, an administrative state or what has become a fourth branch of government, destroys the very idea of a representative legislature and does severe damage to the separation of powers doctrine. Departments and agencies created by Congress are attached to the executive branch and exercise lawmaking power that is both delegated and not delegated by Congress. And their myriad regulations and rules have the force of law, including criminal and civil penalties. Under present conditions, the administrative state's omnipresence makes congressional oversight, political accountability, and rational reform mostly impractical, if not impossible. And Congress seems more than willing to abandon its core function to the executive branch and accept the status quo, having taken rare and minor steps to rein in the bureaucracy. Ironically, judicial review, which is exercised vigorously and expansively by the courts, is all but non-existent in matters involving congressional delegations to administrative agencies. They mostly defer to the discretion of Congress, and with few exceptions, uphold administrative actions to the extent they consider them seriously at all. Moreover, on those occasions when the Supreme Court does exercise judicial review in these matters, it has been known to extend the power of the administrative state beyond Congress's already broad delegations. For example, in the 2007 case Massachusetts versus Environmental Protection Agency, by a 5-4 vote, the court actually expanded the Environmental Protection Agency's EPA authority to regulate carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, despite the agency's long-held determination that these gases are not pollutants subject to regulation. The court opened the door to an infinite number of agency regulations, affecting an endless line of industries, products, and processes. The modern administrative state has power, resources, and tentacles that boggle the mind. For example, in 2008, the Small Business Administration estimated that annual regulatory compliance costs amounted to $1.752 trillion. In 2012, the Obama administration issued new regulations costing $236 billion. New EPA regulations alone resulted in $172 billion in regulatory costs. The 2012 Federal Register, the official federal publication documenting administrative rules and proposed rules, exceeded 77,000 pages. The 2011 and 2010 Federal Registers were 81,247 and 81,405 pages long, respectively. In 2011, regulatory agencies issued 3,807 final rules, yet Congress passed and the President signed 81 laws. In 2012, the bureaucracy reportedly issued 212 economically significant federal rules, each projected to impose more than $100 million in economic costs. In the last 10 years, the issuance of economically significant rules has increased 108%. Furthermore, the number of criminal offenses spawned by these regulations, for which citizens are liable, is unknown even to the federal government. The Heritage Foundation observed that scores of federal departments and agencies have created so many criminal offenses that the Congressional Research Office, CRS, an arm of Congress, admitted that it was unable to even count all the offenses. The service's best estimate? Tens of thousands. Congress's own experts do not have a clear understanding of the size and scope of federal criminalization. Most jarringly, presidents will not hesitate to use the administrative state's rulemaking processes to circumvent Congress when Congress refuses to enact legislation demanded by a president or does not act quickly enough to satisfy a president's ambitions. Indeed, President Barack Obama has declared repeatedly, including in his 2013 State of the Union speech, that if Congress won't act soon to protect future generations, I will, threatening to legislate by executive branch regulation in lieu of congressional action. The system of federalism is also undermined severely when federal departments and agencies commandeer and preempt state authority, destroying state sovereignty and forcing states into their service, or conversely, when states surrender their sovereignty in exchange for federal grants and subsidies conditioned on a state's compliance with the mandates of a federal department or agency. To shed some light on the process, it is worth a brief primer on administrative law, in plain English, of course. Consider that in 1972, Congress passed the Clean Water Act, a law that empowered the EPA to take steps to reduce water pollution by enacting rules or regulations. Once Congress grants such regulatory authority, the agency has discretion to achieve the stated goal. The actual process of enacting a regulation is somewhat technical. Regulations often originate with what is called an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. This initial step consists of a proposal of the action the agency is planning. After a given period of time, the agency releases a proposed rule for the public to consider and, if moved, submit formal comments on. Comments pertaining to a given rule are usually filed by those parties or individuals who have a specific interest in the substance of the rule. The EPA will elicit comments from, say, environmental groups or businesses affected by the regulation. Comments are intended to notify the agency of any legal or perceived legal deficiencies in the proposed rule. Interested parties can notify the agency of widespread support or opposition. The standard time frame for submission of comments to a proposed rule is usually 60 days. In truth, the process is not always as transparent and professionally objective as might appear on the surface. It can be beset with political and ideological agendas, cronyism, and secret communications, making the comment period a formality, not a serious pursuit of useful information and advice. The agency has wide latitude in determining when to promulgate a final rule. The Congressional Review Act, CRA, provides that Congress may review these rules and, if a joint resolution susceptible to a presidential veto passes, the rule can be overruled. Since 1996, Congress has only disapproved a single rule. Clearly, the CRA is not an effective tool for ensuring congressional oversight or curbing regulatory overreach. Private parties wishing to challenge the legality of the final rule are obligated generally to file a petition in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit within 60 days of the promulgation of the final rule. Challenging the legality of a regulation is a difficult and expensive process and succeeds in very limited instances. A number of factors make challenging federal regulations in court particularly difficult. First, the court hearing the challenge presumes, as discussed earlier, that the rule is valid. The private party challenging the regulation must demonstrate that the agency exceeded its rulemaking authority. The burden is on private parties to show that the rule or regulation is illegal. Under current law, the reviewing court will rule a given regulation improper if it determines the agency acted in an arbitrary or capricious manner, or if the agency abused its discretion or acted not in accordance with the law. Therefore, an agency's rule will be upheld, provided it is rationally based. What constitutes rationally based is not always clear, and individuals and groups spend many thousands of dollars on expensive lawyers who attempt to convince courts the agency has acted in an unreasonable manner. It is difficult, if not impossible, for most individuals to husband the resources and expertise to challenge effectively these regulations. Even lawyers who specialize in administrative law often fail. Moreover, most citizens have no idea that rules that may affect their daily lives are being promulgated. Given the insular nature of the process, the quantity of regulations being issued, and the news media's disinterest. Second, courts have dismissed categorically the allegation that a particular agency action or regulation constitutes impermissible legislative activity. In other words, courts reject the argument that Congress cannot delegate its core function of legislating to an executive branch entity, known as the non-delegation doctrine. The Constitution's plain language makes clear that Congress is vested all legislative powers herein granted. But the Supreme Court has declared the doctrine unworkable, which in turn damages the separation of powers doctrine. The Court, which often exercises judicial review in an activist fashion, believes it is almost never qualified to second-guess Congress regarding the permissible degree of policy judgment that can be left to those executing or applying the law. Another factor favoring federal agency rulemaking authority is the overwhelming deference paid by the courts to the agency's positions. When private entities challenge a given regulation, they often allege that the agency acted improperly. Under a Supreme Court-invented legal standard known as the Chevron Doctrine, when Congress passes a broadly worded law, the agency's interpretation of what the law means will be controlling, unless such interpretation is unreasonable. Thus, for example, Congress passes a generic, benign statute and delegates the authority to work out the details of the law to the federal bureaucracy, which is not accountable to the electorate. Lower courts, which often hear cases involving regulatory challenges, are bound by the Chevron Doctrine and will uphold agency regulations in all but the most extraordinary challenges. There are numerous regulations that exceed their respective statutory mandates, so many, in fact, that they cannot all be discussed here. However, a group of recent environmental regulations, recently upheld as valid by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, illustrate the desirability of the proposed amendment. In 1970, Congress passed significant amendments to the Clean Air Act, CAA, that were designed to reduce air pollution from stationary sources, such as factories and power plants, and mobile sources, such as cars and airplanes. The newly created EPA was tasked with enforcing and administering the law. Congress passed additional amendments to the CAA in 1973 and 1990. Each time, Congress decided to expand the EPA's authority to regulate a growing number of hazardous substances. Fast forward to 2009. Carbon emissions, a very small fraction of greenhouse gas emissions, GHGs, became the target of, among others, the environmental movement. But Congress refused to pass new legislation expanding the CAA's coverage to include greenhouse gases, for they are not pollutants. Nevertheless, then EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, admitting the CAA was not an ideal tool, decided she would use the more than 40-year-old statute for curbing carbon emissions. As such, She and the president were bypassing Congress. The CAA's provisions are not designed for carbon regulation. For example, a program operated under the CAA known as the Prevention of Significant Deterioration, PSD, mandates specific pollution thresholds for triggering regulatory requirements. These thresholds are specifically set in the statute itself. Therefore, if a power plant emits 250 tons per year of a pollutant, the PSD program obligates that power plant to take costly steps to remediate the pollution. Congress considered the merits of setting the threshold numbers and passed a specific law setting those numbers. Hence, Congress does have the practical capacity to do such things. When the EPA decided to use the CAA as legal justification for passing regulations relating to greenhouse gas emissions, the EPA was obligated to comply with that law's provisions. Greenhouse gases are emitted by stationary sources, even HVAC systems numbering in the millions. All of these sources emit GHGs in excess of 250 tons per year. Since the Prevention of Significant Deterioration program was expanded at the instigation of the EPA and not by statute, the EPA would logically have to regulate these millions of stationary sources. But realizing the impossibility of the task, Jackson noted that the CAA was not the proper law for regulating GHGs. Consequently, she decided the EPA would discard existing statutory law and set new regulatory thresholds for GHGs. When challenged, the D.C. Circuit upheld the changes, deferring to the EPA's authority. Another example. On March 22, 2010, Congress passed Obamacare, a bill some 2,700 pages long. An analysis by Peter Ferrara of the Heartland Institute concludes the law establishes more than 150 new bureaucracies, agencies, boards, commissions, and programs that are empowered to tell doctors and hospitals what is quality health care and what is not, what are best practices in medicine, how their medical practices should be structured, and what they will be paid and when. The Congressional Research Service reported the precise number of new entities that will ultimately be created is currently unknowable. The regulatory burden and cost will be enormous, and during the early stages of the law's implementation, the executive branch has already issued 20,000 pages of regulations and thousands more to come. Initial Internal Revenue Service regulations alone amount to 159 pages. When Congress passed Obamacare, it attempted by statute to confer fundamental legislative powers on the executive branch, and even sought to prohibit future Congresses from altering its unconstitutional act. Specifically, Congress created the 15-member Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB, which ostensibly is responsible for controlling Medicare costs. The board submits a proposal to Congress, which automatically becomes law, and the Department of Health and Human Services must implement it, unless the proposal is blocked by Congress and the President. Even then, it can only be stopped if the elected branches agree on a substitute. Obamacare also prohibits citizens from challenging the board's decisions in court. Moreover, Obamacare seeks to tie the hands of future Congresses by forbidding Congress from repealing the board outside of a 7-month period in 2017, and only by a supermajority 3/5 vote of both houses. If Congress does not act in that time frame, Congress is prohibited from even altering a board proposal. Apart from all the rest, the abuse of power by one Congress and President in attempting to reorganize the federal government and redraft fundamentally the Constitution outside of the amendment processes with the intention of binding all future Congresses in perpetuity and leaving citizens with no political or legal recourse, is simply sinister. But it underscores the statists' contempt for the Constitution and self-government. Shortly thereafter, on July 21, 2010, the same Congress passed and the President signed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, a.k.a. Dodd-Frank, supposedly intended to protect the consumer from risky decisions by financial institutions. The law is as offensive to the Constitution as Obamacare, again violating separation of powers and insulating broad policymaking decisions from the citizenry. For example, under Dodd-Frank, Congress established the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, which has open-ended power to prevent certain financial institutions from committing or engaging in unfair, deceptive, or abusive practices respecting a consumer financial product or service. No statutory definition for unfair or deceptive acts or practices is provided. The CFPB has exclusive authority to prescribe rules, issue guidance, conduct examinations, require reports, or issue exemptions, with little legal recourse by those affected by its decisions. Moreover, Congress has no appropriating authority over the CFPB, for the law authorizes the CFPB to fund itself by unilaterally claiming funds from the Federal Reserve Board. The director of the CFPB alone determines the amount of funding the CFPB receives from the Fed. The law also prohibits explicitly the House and Senate Appropriations Committees from even attempting to review the CFPB's budget, and the director receives a 5-year term. He can only be removed by the president for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. In addition, Congress established the 15-member Financial Stability Oversight Council and granted it broad executive powers. It has open-ended discretion to designate non-bank financial institutions systemically important, from which flows wide-ranging regulatory authority over these businesses. The law actually prohibits aggrieved parties from challenging the legal sufficiency of the council's actions and conclusions in court. The delegation of colossal power to an administrative state, authority the Constitution grants to individual branches of the federal government, violates the separation of powers doctrine, including Congress's legislative authority and power over the public purse, and presidential prerogatives in determining whether to fire an executive branch employee. It also thwarts the public's ability to participate in major legal, social, cultural, and economic decisions affecting their lives through the grant and expansion of lawmaking power in bureaucratic fiefdoms. Plain and simple, this is further evidence of the dissolution of constitutional republicanism. It would seem counterintuitive for Congress to surrender its own power to executive branch entities of its own making, and for a president to surrender his own decision-making authority to an administrative state. But if the purpose is to centralize and concentrate power in the federal government, in defiance of our founding principles and the Constitution, as the statists have preached and promoted actively for more than a century, then the frequent and broad delegation of lawmaking power to a permanent, ever-present federal bureaucracy, immune from public influence, makes perfect sense. The proposed amendment bypasses the issue of delegation per se, the total reversal of which would seem impossible at this point. But importantly, it returns final decision-making authority respecting laws, regulations, and rules with significant economic impact to Congress, thereby restoring a critical element of separation of powers under the Constitution and reinvigorating representative government. The proposed amendment sunsets every executive federal department and agency and obligates Congress to determine the efficacy of each entity every 3 years. It also establishes a permanent joint committee which makes final determinations respecting the most economically costly federal regulations. The proposed amendment does not prevent Congress from otherwise abolishing or creating federal departments or agencies, modifying their missions, or affecting their directions, policies, and funding. However, given Congress's abandonment of its core constitutional duty, thereby gutting the fundamental nature of representative government, the proposed amendment is among the only ways to rebalance the legislative function of the federal government. The proposed amendment embraces the framers' original plan. Congress legislates, not administrative agencies within the executive branch. It obligates Congress to undertake the duties intended by the framers and set forth in the Constitution, prohibiting it from delegating and abdicating final authority over major laws. Chapter 7. An Amendment to Promote Free Enterprise. Section 1. Congress's power to regulate commerce is not a plenary grant of power to the federal government to regulate and control economic activity, but a specific grant of power limited to preventing states from impeding commerce and trade between and among the several states. Section 2. Congress's power to regulate commerce does not extend to activity within a state, whether or not it affects interstate commerce, nor does it extend to compelling an individual or entity to participate in commerce or trade. The Constitution's Commerce Clause states that Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states, and with the Indian tribes. The proposed amendment focuses on that part of the clause respecting Congress's power to regulate commerce among the several states, and addresses the federal government's ever-expanding involvement in and interference with private economic activity and property rights. It is at first essential to understand what the framers meant by these words and the framers' purpose. In 1996, the late constitutional expert and Harvard Law professor Raoul Berger explained that the focus on trade alone was not fortuitous. The framers were fastidious in their choice of words. For them, trade did not, for example, include agricultural production, which plainly was local. In the convention, George Mason said that the general government could not know how to make laws for every part, state, such as respects agriculture. And Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist No. 17 that the supervision of agriculture and of other concerns of a similar nature, which are proper to be provided for by local legislation, can never be desirable cares of a general jurisdiction. In Federalist No. 12, he adverted to the rivalship that once subsisted between agriculture and commerce. Hamilton referred separately in Federalist No. 36 to agriculture, commerce, and manufactures as different kinds of wealth, property, and industry, not as fused in commerce. In sum, the founders conceived of commerce as trade, the interchange of goods by one state with another. Berger added, the founders' all but exclusive concern was with exactions by some states from their neighbors. James Madison said, it would be unjust to the states whose produce was exported by their